Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 209 of Game Master's Journey. I'm your host, Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and the art of game mastering. I've been running RPGs for over 26 years now, and I produce this show in the hopes that you can benefit from my experience, my triumphs, and my mistakes. Matthew Colville rejoins me on the show today to discuss his upcoming D&D 5th edition supplement, Strongholds and Followers. This long-awaited tome is just part of Matt's Kickstarter campaign, Strongholds and Streaming. The campaign's also providing some awesome gemstone dragon miniatures, as well as studio space, so Matt can produce a high-quality actual play of his next campaign. So we're going to talk about all of those things today, as well as some other GM topics, including strongholds and followers in your D&D games in general. So I'm really excited to have Matthew back on the show. He was last on a couple years ago for episode 101, and I know that that is a favorite episode for a lot of the listener GMs out there. So I'm really excited that Matt is back with us today. And so without further ado, we're going to move on to the interview. So Matt Colville is joining me again, and you are currently doing a Kickstarter called Strongholds and Streaming. Yes. And this is for your Strongholds and Followers source book,
yep,
as well as to fund a studio to produce a live stream of your next campaign.
Yep.
And your Kickstarter is kicking ass and taking names, man. I mean,
it's super popular, people. It was very popular very quickly. I think that's almost entirely because of the community we put together.
Yeah.
I've certainly seen a lot of people online, a lot of people in the traditional tabletop business trying to understand what's going on in terms of identifying a product that they could make that people would want the way it appears that they want this product. But that's not what I did. That's not what I did. I built a community first.
Yeah.
I built a community, and then I put a product in front of the community, and some people want that product and some people just want to say thanks. And yeah, so that's the lesson from this, is that we're a lot of the people in the tabletop business. You know, I'm a freelance. I'm a independent fantasy author, and a lot of my fellow authors, they don't like promoting themselves.
Yeah.
Right? They don't like a lot of the people in the tabletop business. They don't want to get out there and smile on camera and stuff. They just want to make books. And but the reality is that if you build a community, if you can do that, then that community will support you. That's what we're learning.
Yeah, and you have a very active YouTube channel where you dole out just tons of fantastic advice for new GMs, experienced GMs, and anybody listening to this that doesn't know about your channel must be new or not paying attention, because we talk about your channel a lot on this show. There's really? A lot
That's good. That makes me happy. It's kind of freaks me out a little bit. I'm always surprised. I don't know why I should be, but I'm always surprised to talk to people that watch the channel, because I in the back of my head, I'm always like, well, there are way better things you could be doing. but yeah, it just makes me happy that people are watching. In fact, I'm getting ready for an episode as soon as I'm done with you.
Oh, cool. We're
gonna talk about 3D combat.
Nice. And
so I'm going to hopefully get a video up tonight or tomorrow, because I've been doing so many videos about the Kickstarter that I'm aware that the people that, you know, maybe they pledged, maybe they didn't. Either way, they're supporting the D&D content. They don't want the channel to turn into the all Kickstarter content. So doing a thing about the fact that the Dungeons & Dragons universe is not Euclidean. It is not a Euclidean world. It does not obey, the Pythagorean theorem does not obtain in Dungeons & Dragons. And that actually makes the DM's life easier if they're trying to figure out altitude for something like a 3D combat.
Well, I'm going to look forward to that. That sounds really, really useful.
I think there's I'm sort of giving you a preview of the video, but I think there's an assumption that we all go through, that 3D combat has to be a headache because suddenly you have hypotenuses to calculate.
Right, right.
Because a person is a certain distance away, and then they're a certain distance up, and we're all aware, even if we don't know a squared plus b squared equals c squared, we're all aware that this is a third number.
Right, sure.
And that the actual distance is a third number, but not in D&D, not since fourth edition. That is not true.
Cool.
Because in fourth edition, and this is still true in fifth edition, the distance from one square to all squares adjacent is the same. It's always one square. And that's not how the real world works. In the real world, diagonals are farther away.
Right.
Not
D&D. Right.
That makes it so that if you know either number, if I know either the distance out or the distance up, I know the range because it's one of those two numbers. It's the larger one of the two of them. So if somebody's seven out and three up, they're seven away.
Cool.
Like, it doesn't matter if you're underwater or in the air or if they're above you or below you. If you know both numbers, then you automatically know how far away they are. And I think that data alone and a tchotchke, like this thing I'm holding up, which is a little piece of plastic combat tier I got from Paizo. You put those two things together and I think 3D combat becomes a lot more manageable.
Yeah. Awesome. That's awesome. And I was not aware of what you're talking about. So I look forward to learning more.
Well, it started by me posting somebody asking about aerial combat or underwater combat. And I was like, well, don't forget D&D's universe is non-Euclidean. And I sort of expected I expected people reading that to be like, what? But I also assumed that there would be some people. You can usually rely on the people, of the people following me, the ones that don't get what I'm talking about, the ones who do get it will explain it to them.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't necessarily have to do all. I don't have to do everything. One part of the community will reinforce the other part of the community. That was the first instance where no one knew what I was talking about. So I was like, I've got to make a video about this.
Yeah. Maybe if you would have mentioned Pythagoras, maybe somebody would have figured it out. But
yeah, Yeah, exactly. But I didn't. I actually one of the things I enjoy is sometimes I can tell the person I'm talking to needs me to like really explain, really give them a piece of wisdom that will set them off. But oftentimes I enjoy just espousing this kind of cryptic ex cathedra wisdom, like the Oracle of Delphi. And then people are like, what? People are like, what is he talking about? And then someone else explains it. And they're like, oh, okay. Because to me, that's part of the fun. Part of the fun is people figuring things out as opposed to me just being explicit about everything.
All you got to do is start talking like Yoda on top of it. And
that's not bad. I could do that.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk. So there's a lot going on with your Kickstarter. Let's start off talking about the Strongholds and Followers source book. And I personally think this is a very much needed supplement for D&D 5th edition.
We'll see,
And I don't think I'm alone in that because I checked this morning and you've already hit 1.3 million on a Kickstarter.
Yeah, but remember, a lot of that is folks that just supporting the YouTube channel.
Sure.
It remains to be seen how popular the book will be in the D&D community at large. And it would be great if it was very popular. I would like that. And it's going to be largely a combination of my design and playtesting. We'll get a lot of feedback based on the playtest docs. But, I think that folks that are fans of my channel, they will get this more than other people because they are familiar with my philosophy. Right. And if you're not familiar with that philosophy, well, actually, I already do a lot of work in the book just explaining my point of view and explaining why things work the way they do in this book. And also to a certain extent, why they work the way they do in D&D in the first place. And between those things, between the design and the explanation of the design, it's my hope that people really use it. I was the author of, I was the lead designer. I wasn't the only author. I was the lead designer on a book from Eden Studios, the guys that make, they make a bunch of games. They make All Flesh Must Be Eaten, but they had a line of D20 books back in the third edition era. And I did a book called The Book of War, Fields of Blood, The Book of War, which is a mass combat realm management solution that came out along with a bunch of other products from other companies. And ours, I think, was the most well-reviewed. So there is reason to suspect that the product might be useful. but again, the success of the Kickstarter is 90% the success of the YouTube channel.
Well, I personally am super excited about this book. You were teasing about this 2 years ago when you were on the show. Yeah. And I, like you, really enjoy the style of play that this book is addressing, that for me really harkens back to what I like to call the good old days of D&D. Yeah. The whole idea of building a stronghold and attracting followers that definitely in fifth edition, we haven't seen much support for that. And You know, it's funny because 2 years ago when I talked to you about this, I was kicking around my own ideas because this is a style of play I very much enjoy. And after hearing you talk about what you're doing, I decided not to reinvent the wheel and I was just going to wait for your book to come out.
I'm sorry I made you wait so long. Huh?
No, it's all right. It's going to be good timing, actually.
Well, it's the kind of thing where I'm from a tradition where every group had their own solution for this stuff.
Yeah,
there was actually it's a style of play that is directly referenced in the original books from the 70s, but not it's referenced, but then not explained. And at the time, I think that's because D&D exists as this strange and possibly unique combination of like Monopoly is sort of like this of a game and a tradition.
Yeah.
Right. Like a lot of people play Monopoly wrong and they don't realize they're playing it wrong because it exists as much as a tradition as it does a rule set. And the people participating in that tradition in the 70s, they all had their own war games that they had been using and they had their own, like they had chainmail and chainmail wasn't the only one. And so for them, much as fifth edition is very much about using natural language and empowering the DM to make rulings and not trying to explain everything, it was considered virtuous in the 70s. And even still when I was playing in the 80s to develop your own rules for this stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And it was kind of, you know, it was just like designing your own world and designing your own adventures. And so different dungeon masters had different rules for this. And these are mine. And they're sort of a synthesis of a bunch of different friends of mine and all the rules that we were all sort of communally using.
Yeah. And so I have a lot of listeners that are new to the hobby. So maybe you could talk to us just a little bit about this style of play that this book is for. That maybe they're not aware of.
I mean, I think to me, the clearest thing is that it's about ambition. It's about your, like, you know, it's easy to break the game down into adventuring, into going into dungeons, into going on adventures. And we have lots of antecedents there that we can draw from. Everyone's seen The Lord of the Rings and everyone is sort of expecting, plus now Critical Role does this, where the campaign is ultimately the story of these itinerant mercenaries who become heroes and ultimately save the world. And that's fine, right? Somebody's going to throw the ring into Mount Doom. Someone's going to stab the final aspect or whatever it was called into Vecna. And that's going to be the end of the game. But the game in the 70s and in the 80s, it started that same way, itinerant mercenaries. But the expectation was that your character was going to want things on their own. Like, apart from saving the world, actually saving the world wasn't, it's much more in the tradition of like Conan, right? Conan, not just Conan, but the Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser and that kind of pulp fantasy, which these days I think is underrepresented. It's not missing. It's underrepresented in D&D. And if Lord of the Rings is epic romance, right? It's the epic meaning the stakes are huge. It's the world is at stake. And romance meaning a romantic view of the past, a romantic and unrealistic view of the past. Then Strongholds and Followers is more about that individual ambition. What do you want to do? And to me, a hallmark of a successful D&D campaign, and we'll talk about this probably in one of the update videos, has always been, I always know that it's working. I am a dungeon master. I'm being successful when, usually around third level, the players have cleared out whatever it was that was the problem. And they say, hey, we should make this place our base.
Yeah. Right?
If they don't do that, right? If all they're doing is thinking about, well, now that we're at Rivendell and we've gotten our items identified, now we have to go to, you have to go through Moria. And then we have to go, if all they're thinking about is the next stage in their quest to collect all the plot coupons, but then they can deliver them to the game master at the end of the campaign and get as their reward the end of the story, then I feel like I've sort of let them down because that's the way video games work.
Yeah.
Video games are about you start off the first level and you're killing rats in an inn or whatever, but ultimately you're going to save the world. And they have to be that way because they can't ask you the question, what do you want to do?
Right.
Because if they asked you that question, you would come up with answers that a video game cannot account for because there's going to be, you know, 3 million people playing the game. And that's arguably 3 million different answers.
Sure.
Whereas here with D&D, we have dungeon masters. I've only got 6 players. I can ask them, what do they, on purpose, I design organizations and I make even the bad guy organizations seem cool because I want the players to go, those guys are awesome. I want to be one. I want to join that group. I put rumors of magic items. I make sure the players have access to the magic items in the Dungeon Master's Guide because I want them to want them. I want the players to go, what is the staff? What's the rod of seven parts? This is cool. I want it.
Yeah.
And to me, that's all about ambition and the players being self-motivated. And there's nothing wrong with that style of play where it's all for one and one for all. And we're going to throw the ring into Mount Doom. I like playing that way. But I also like the more pulp fantasy, like Conan, we don't know what his background is. The dude shows up in the middle of the town. He's an adult. We don't see him as a kid. That's ridiculous. And he's at a bar and he's like, what's that big tower in the middle of town? And somebody goes, oh, that's the Tower of the Elephant. There's a great treasure at the top of it, but it's unscalable. He's like, hold my beer. Right? That's the style. That's the tradition. Like, I literally had a friend of mine after I started my own, I became a landed noble. And I built a stronghold on the Duke's land. I was a count now and I was a lawful good paladin. And so I was kind of, becoming part of this feudal system. And I was happy with that. My friend Dave was a chaotic good mage and didn't want to have anything to do with that, but he envied my stronghold. And so he literally just pointed to a place on the Greyhawk map and asked our DM, what's over here? And he's like, oh, there's some barbarian tribes. And he goes, I am going to take this place over.
Nice.
He decided that. And he was like a ninth level wizard. And he assumed that if there's just a bunch of barbarian tribes here, I should be able to just take this place over. And our DM said, okay. And he came up with a whole adventure that Dave went on all by himself. I didn't have anything to do with that. We weren't there. And at the end of that adventure, he was Baron Kale. That's the kind of, and then we got back together, went and saved the world like that. They're not mutually exclusive. These styles of play, the notion of working together for a common goal. I liken it to baseball, right? Where half the time we're working together on defense. And then the other half of the time it's down to individual achievement and it's your turn at bat. And it's up to you to come up with your own goals.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And you know, we do see this discussed some in the books, you know, talking about as you advance through the tiers of play, you're going to have more and more influence. First, it's local, then it's regional. But yeah, we're not given an actual toolkit to use as the how would that work?
Correct. Yeah. We're not given the mechanisms to somebody was just watching somebody just went back. I guess these things are not obvious. I put them on YouTube because I wanted people to watch them. But you can go back and watch our old streams. We've streamed the game twice now. And somebody said, I just watched one of Matt's streams. And the thing that struck me was his players all have like titles and they have responsibilities and they are looked up to, but they're only sixth level.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't respond, but my reaction, what I wanted to say was like, yeah, because we were close to the end, right? Like if you only intend on playing for like 6 months or whatever, you can't wait. You can't wait for the players to be 11th or 12th level to become, you know, give them the stuff early. Why not? Yeah. If you do plan on a long campaign, then you definitely need to dole that stuff out more slowly. But I thought, you know, we'd get to fifth or sixth level and stop, which we did. And so I made sure that by the time when they rescued the town, right, when the third level and they've saved the town, at this point, good stuff starts happening to them. They become famous. They get, you know, titles and followers and stuff like that. And that was just at third level. I mean, in the original game, that was supposed to happen when you were like seventh level. And that would be like a year of play, I think, more than a year sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think you've said, I've heard you say, I think on your Kickstarter videos that you've been working on these rules in some way, shape or form for something like 30 years.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about kind of the history of your rules for this and maybe how they've evolved through the different editions?
Well, I mean, they're very simple. They're what I learned was, I initially had a very, very simple rule set that was kind of, like I said, a synthesis of all my different friends and the different rules that we used. And they mostly involved just spending money and rolling on charts. And there wasn't any sense of it was up to the dungeon master to figure out what does getting this follower mean.
Okay.
And there weren't rules for that kind of stuff. And so in first edition and second edition, we were fine with that. And I just would rewrite them and expand on them. But then once third edition came around and I was now a professional game designer, I was like, okay, it's time to take these rules and make them actually work the way things in third edition do, which was also, by the way, in accord with my philosophy, which is that like I was working on the Lord of the Rings role-playing game. And one of the authors of it submitted some of his work, which was the seven virtues, seven virtues in Tolkien's writing. And he knew a lot about Tolkien and his writing and about his beliefs. And he was able to identify these seven virtuous philosophies that all characters in Tolkien's work espouse to one extent or another. And it was really interesting to read. And I was like, this is amazing. What happens when I pick one of these? And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, what do I get for choosing one of these? Right. And he goes, you don't get anything. That's ridiculous. They're just philosophies. And I was like, okay, well, I feel like you just let me down. because you did all this cool work.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel the opposite, you know, and every designer draws that line. You can't do everything for the players, right? You can't, you have to stop somewhere. You have to stop designing somewhere. Otherwise you end up with third edition. But I was disappointed. And so in third edition, I want to make sure that building a keep did something different for you than building a tower. Building a tower always let you do spell research all the way back to 1986 when I started playing. But what spell research meant was never written down. It was always DM fiat behind the screens, right? It was always the player saying, well, I have a tower now, and you said that meant I could research spells. I would like to make a spell that does this.
Yeah.
And the DM goes, all right, well, the DM doesn't know what that means. I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but what I can do is I can throw you some breadcrumbs to get you started in the process while I figure out if that spell even makes sense, or, you know, so that you don't even realize I don't know what's going on. You feel like the DM, I'm confident, and I've given you clues as to who you should talk to or what you should do. And this could be an adventure on its own, going and getting the components and doing the research to figure out if this spell is possible. So that has always been part of the rules, but it's around about 2000. I was like, I want to actually know what this means, right? What are the mechanical benefits for? There should always be, there should often be mechanical benefits to these things. So, you know, you're a different, a character with a keep is different than a character without one. It just depends on what you want to do. For instance, right now in the rules, you buy a keep because you want to raise an army. I often refer to building or attracting units, but I have to remind myself that not everyone knows what I mean by that. You know, like a unit of veteran light infantry. For instance, that's one unit. You want to raise an army. Well, an army doesn't do anything for you in combat. An army is a thing that lets you defend your keep, and it lets you project your power out. And so you can go on an adventure and tell your lieutenant, hey, I want you to take our army, and I want you to go occupy this border province because this guy is pissing me off. Right. And now that has meaning. Now you can do something with that. And when Kingdoms and Warfare comes out, that system will be even greater elaborated upon. But I'm aware that if you're a wizard player and you have a tower, or really any spellcaster, and you have a tower, you can modify your spells. You can hack your spells in ways that, like, a sorcerer can't, in ways that would be reminiscent to somebody of fourth edition, for instance. And you could possibly invent a new spell. Well, that does help you in combat.
Yeah.
So now, at this point, I, as a designer, there have been times in my life when I've been okay with that. And I explicitly say this in the text. I say, not all players care about this stuff. It's perfectly reasonable for one player in the party just to have cooler shit than everybody else, as long as the other players are happy with their cool shit.
Right.
And sure. Something that only you as the dungeon master know. Only you know the psychology of your players. So if your fighter player with a keep is sort of pissed because the wizard player has cooler spells now and he doesn't have anything except an army that he can't really use in combat, here's a whole other set of rules for that player who runs a keep for weapon training. The idea being that you've still got an army, still about raising an army. You have to train your guys and you've got your pet weapons. And depending on which weapons you use, you now get additional abilities in combat that bring you up to speed with the wizard. And in both instances, these things wear out. Like, you're going to run out of the spell, you're going to run out of your weapon training, and you got to go back to your keep to kind of freshen up and remind yourself how these things work. Because we want to give the player reasons to return to their home. Otherwise, there's a danger, especially with the way D&D works. So if you can end up starting an adventure at 5th or 6th level and not come home until your 15th level because you went to the other planes and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the past, the way to get him home was to attack the keep. And that can get old after you do it 3 times.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and now... And players, I think I'm a big fan of doing the work for it. It always bugs me when I'm like watching a movie and, you know, and Neo and Carrie Ann Moss fall in love at the end because I guess they have to.
Right. Because the plot demands it.
Because you definitely get the sense from the authors of like, well, you guys have seen movies, right? You know how it works.
Yeah.
We have to do it all. And I'm like, well, in some cases, yeah, you have to do the work for it. And so like making the player go back to their, giving them a reason. You don't have to do it, but giving the player you're still a fully functional character if you don't do this, remember. You're still a D&D character without this.
Yeah.
But it gives the player a reason to return home, and that will make their home seem more like a real place.
Awesome. So there's two main kind of aspects of this book, I'd say, and it's right there in the title, Strongholds and Followers.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about, a bit more about the Stronghold rules as far as like, what's going to be involved with getting a stronghold versus building one or maintaining it, stuff like that?
You just spend a lot of money and you take some time and you've got a stronghold. And that's on purpose because I want it to be, I didn't want to design, like the DM's guide has advice for that, right? Like what I'm adding to it is, why would you want to do such a thing?
Okay.
I'm not trying to make it more complex. I'm not trying to make it harder to make a stronghold. I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, I've got a ton of money. I want a stronghold. Well, the way you do that is basically you attract townspeople, right? Like people show up to help you, people who are tired of the place they live or people that you've helped out, that you got that gold somehow. And they want to help you. And so it takes time, and the amount of time it takes and how much money it takes depends on whether or not you are building a stronghold from scratch, which I actually think is pretty rare, but it could happen. Or if you're just renovating something that already exists, like the more well-developed a given place is, then the less it costs to convert it into your keep.
Sure.
And there's always going to be some DM fiat required here, because again, there isn't a system for, okay, count the number of squares in this ruined tower that reduces the cost by this amount. We're gonna have advice on what counts as a ruin and what counts as a damaged keep and okay. stuff like that. Enough for a dungeon master to have their own. It's not important that you have the same idea that I have. It's important that you have a clear idea,
right? Sure.
You're reading through the rules, and if you feel like I get it. The fact that might not be what I intended doesn't matter, because it's your game. As long as you feel like the rule, I've read lots of D&D products where I thought I understood what the author meant, especially with adventures. But then when I tried to run it, it turned out I had no idea what they were talking about.
Yeah.
And so my goal is to use clear, familiar language to communicate directly to the reader so that they have some understanding of how this stuff is supposed to work and they're not confused.
Now, a question I have for you, I think I know the answer to this, but I'll ask it for everyone else's benefit. Do you see the stronghold as the resource and responsibility of a single player, or is it something that a group could manage together, or is it both?
Well, there isn't really anything to manage, right? The idea is if it becomes a resource management issue, if it becomes something where like you're playing a mini game in order to keep your keep, then I think that's too much work and too much overhead. You're already playing Dungeons and Dragons, which is one of the most complex games anyone ever plays. There is no more complex RPG, for instance.
Yeah.
In fact, like all RPGs these days are simpler than D&D. So it's not something where I feel like it's going to take a group of people to manage, but there's nothing stopping a group of people from chipping in together and buying one big stronghold and having there be a tower over here and a keep over here. That would be very simple. But the system assumes that the keep, the system assumes that not everyone in your group is going to want the same thing. Okay. And in my experience, it's very rare that everyone agrees. I think there are many times in which two or three players are the ones speaking out, and it seems like everybody agrees, but actually the other players are just going along with it because they don't care.
Sure. Yeah.
And so I'm trying to cater to those who are engaged and are like, I want to do this. And I've known a lot of players, like my friend Tom. I thought that guy was going to want to build a monastery because he had talked about it. But then he was like, no, I don't like the idea of being tied down to a place. Fair enough. Okay. That's fine. So the rules assume that the keep or the stronghold belongs to the person that built them. But there's nothing stopping people from chipping in together and all running a keep. And there's rules, or not rules, really. There's advice for how to dole out the different benefits of it. Like my friend Phil had he repaired Broken Spire Keep. Actually, it was EJ repairing Broken Spire Keep and letting Phil use the spire as his tower. That was really straightforward.
Cool. Yeah. So I guess that's kind of what I was referring to, is that the benefits that the PCs would get, because I could see a situation where maybe you have two characters who want a stronghold, and I was just wondering, would they each have to have their own individual stronghold, or could they go in halvesies on one?
I think a lot of dungeon masters actually don't even want to have to worry about the monetary issue.
Right.
Right.
Sure.
A lot of these things can be done by fiat, right? Yeah. Like you guys have solved the adventure. You beat the bad guys. This place is yours now. Congratulations. Do what you want with it. Right. You guys now have a keep or a tower or a temple. And there's no, there's nothing stopping two priests, or they don't have to be priests. Like, it's a fantasy universe. Lots of people worship gods. There's nothing stopping, a fighter from building a temple, or three, a fighter and a ranger and a druid to all pitch in together and run this temple and get the benefits from it.
Cool. And you've mentioned the tower for spellcasters and a keep for more martial types. Are there some other different general types of strongholds that you're working on?
Well, the four core strongholds are keeps, which allow you, they generate units all by themselves.
Okay.
Because anybody can hire mercenaries. There are rules for that.
Right.
And every follower chart has units on it. So depending on how you roll, you know, you're building a stronghold. A company could show up and say, we would rather work for you than for the guy that lost the last war we were in. So that's what keeps are for, and keeps also grant you access to an optional rule for weapons training. Towers let you research spells. Temples let you buff like whole provinces, right? But they also let you summon creatures. You can have, that's for warlocks and clerics who, if you're not using, I try to make sure that there's always an option here. If you're not using Kingdoms and Warfare, which is a supplement, you still have something useful that you can do. And then there's establishments, and establishments are businesses, right? Awesome. So, and this is more for an urban campaign or more for the thief, the rogue, the ranger. Anybody can do this. Who, you know, it could be a paladin wants to start a business. And the assumption is that this business is in a population center, a town, a city, and that people come into this business. And through that process, not only do you make money, but you gain information. You are effectively a spy, right? You're learning because people come into the business and they want to spend money and they want to talk to you about the world outside. You're learning about what's going on in other regions, other areas, other local areas. And that has just as, you know, cash is cash. Information has value.
Awesome.
So any player, any character can make any of these. And then there are variations of them. We make sure that a Druid's Grove is covered. I've already written the rules for our Barbarian Camp. With the Pirate Stronghold, I've mentioned this in the update video, is basically a variation of a Pirate Camp, of a Barbarian Camp. Barbarian Camps slow down the bigger they get, but pirate ships speed up. They're both mobile.
Cool.
And they both have the capacity to degrade provinces. Like you can park your barbarian camp on a civilized hex. And there's a chance that at the end of the season, it won't be civilized anymore. It'll be wilderness, because that's what barbarians do. And similarly, a pirate ship you can send it. You could be there when it happens, but this would be more like an adventure. And that's up to the dungeon master. But you can send your pirate ship to a coastal town and you make a roll, and not only do you get a bunch of money, so in a sense, a pirate ship is like an establishment because it generates cash, but also you decrease the development level of that town. It goes from being like, you know, a city to a large town, or a large town to a small town, or a small town to a hamlet. And because that's what pirates do. They raid. When they go on a raid, there was somebody in one of my comments in my videos who was like, shouldn't raiding a town cause the town to increase its prosperity? And I was like, we do not come. Our points of view are too different. if you think that like raiding the pirates raiding a town somehow results in the town being more prosperous, then this is the wrong book for you.
Yeah, that's kind of bizarre.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what happens is when you have a book like this, there are some people, hopefully a lot, that are like, oh, that sounds interesting. I'm interested to see what rules Matt comes up with. But then there are a lot of people who just project what they want onto the book. Like, sure. They don't know what's in the book. They just have wants, and D&D doesn't cover them. And they are, one of the things I'm learning is that they are wide and varied, right?
Yeah.
What people think of, like people without really understanding what they're asking, people assume that there's going to be rules for like thieves guilds in here. And I was like, but a thieves guild is not an object. It's an organization.
Right,
it's a notional concept. Whereas strongholds are physical objects in the world.
Right. Yeah.
And I picked words that I thought like a stronghold is a real thing. And I would like to see rules for, you know, guilds and churches and cults. I've got my own rules for cults that let lots of low level priests act like one big high level priest. And that might be in the Kingdoms and Warfare, because you can certainly see how from a thief's point of view, a very robust thieves guild or an assassin's college or a spy network is like a kingdom.
Yeah.
Right. And they can sort of overlap, which was you can have in a province, you can have an army in a province, and you can have a church in a province, and you can have a spy network in that province. They're by no means mutually exclusive. So I think that stuff's from Kingdoms and Warfare. But that's what I'm learning, is that there's a lot more need than there is subject matter for this book.
Yeah.
And so some people are going to be let down.
I think you could easily do a book just on organizations.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
I completely agree. Yeah.
I'd buy that
would
book.
Be a good place. And that may be that I don't have any plans for that right now. But like I've got I do have plans to do a book for all the crap I've made up for my D&D campaign, and then putting it all in getting art for it and putting it in a book so people can buy without actually saying, here is my D&D campaign. Because I think it's much more useful to say, here are my rules for how monk titles work. Because people have seen that in my game where this one player is the master of locusts. And then he meets the master of ravens. And he knows if I beat this guy in single combat, then I become the master of ravens. And people are like, what is that? I want to know all about that. And I'm like, well, see, that's, I think, more valuable to you than maps of my world. I think you've already got your world. You want to hear about how does the clock, which is a thieves guild in my world, work? And with that kind of stuff, I have plans for. Cool. But yeah, definitely an organization's book I think would be useful. We'll see what this new Mordenkainen's Book of Foes or Tome of Foes or whatever this is going to be, because I think it might be stuff in there for that.
That'd be cool.
So yeah, I'm looking forward to that book, by the way.
Yeah, me too. Another thing I think you mentioned is that this will provide some more things that player characters can do during downtime, which I know a lot of players are always on the lookout for. Can you tell us a little bit about some downtime activities that could tie into this?
Well, like, for instance, there's a bunch of different things in the book, and a lot of it has to do with followers, but also some side effects of your keep. Like, you know, it, once you have an army, you want to do things with it.
Right, sure.
And that's a whole dimension on top of D&D, and it's a fun one, right? And there's going to be a book that turns all this into mechanics. There are rules in there's an appendix in the back of the book. I've already previewed some of these rules for how to use. There's a whole bunch of units you can have in the book, and my basic rules for warfare. So if you and there's going to be a simplified version of it that is just rolling on a chart to see which army wins and which army loses for people that don't want to go through an elaborate battle. That's important. But just having an army changes the way you think about the world that you're in. Because now you can do things besides swing your sword and kill bad guys. You can send your army out to either conquer places or explore places, you know, expand your domain. And the results of that, I think, are fascinating story-wise, right? Now the Dungeon Master is thinking in terms of, well, who are your neighbors? And what do they think about you? What do they think about the fact that all of a sudden you're this upstart that has their own keep and attracted, you know, three units of veteran medium cavalry? And that, to me, is that's just one aspect of this. You know, if you build a tower, one of the things is that you always automatically know where the nearest codex is. And that itself is a lot of stuff from my campaign setting. They're not rules per se. They're content. They're content from my campaign, and I think DMs and players will like them. But just finding, okay, I know where this is now. How do I get it? I think that's an adventure in and of itself. So all these different strongholds all just change. They just open up a vast array, I think, of political and character development options for your character.
Awesome. So you mentioned the codex, and one of the stretch goals you've already hit was some magic items, including these codices. Can you tell us a little bit about what a codex is?
Well, I previewed one of them. I'll do a whole update in the next 2 weeks. I think we're about halfway. This Friday, I think we're halfway through the Kickstarter. So I want to make sure over the next 2 weeks we focus on some of the content that is in the book. And one of those is codices, which is just a thing that I made up because I like the idea of... it's sort of like, what if spell books actually worked the way we all sort of imagine they work, right? Because right now in D&D, they're purely a bookkeeping thing.
Right.
That notion, there are a lot of minis, for instance, like my friend Phil, his mini for Graves, the empty one, the warlock in my last game, he has a big tome under his arm. What is that?
Right.
Is that really just a spell book? Because as far as I can tell, all that is just a bookkeeping. It's like, it makes the wizard seem more like an accountant.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It makes the wizard seem more like an accountant. And that to me is the opposite of how magic is supposed to work. So I'm not trying to replace how spell books work. I just want these wizardly tomes. And by the way, they're not anybody who has a codex gets the benefit of it. But there are these tomes on different subjects. Like there's one on demonology, there's one on golems, the Codex Mechanica, the Codex Automata, I think is what it is. And the and one of them is the Codex Terranosis. There's a Codex Terranosis, and there's also the Codex Umbranosis, I think, which is the Book of Shadow Knowledge. There's a bunch of them, but the Book of, I don't know if you've seen the preview for the Codex Terranosis, but like this gives you an understanding of how I think this stuff should work. And it's one of those things where even if you don't use it, it's going to change the way DMs think about stuff because like, oh, I never thought about that. Like there's a spell in D&D called Banish. And there are rules regarding who gets a saving throw to be banished. And the Codex Terranosis says that as long as this book is on the prime material plane, it takes a saving throw to banish a native off this plane, which is how banish works.
Cool.
So the implication is the reason this spell in D&D works the way it does is because this book is on the prime material plane. And if it leaves, if it goes to the astral plane, or if it's on the plane of fire, then now all of a sudden you can banish somebody without a roll, without them having to save. Right. And the first time that happens, people are gonna be like, we gotta go find that book. We gotta get it back here because this sucks. Right. And it does a lot. That's just one ability, by the way. But I like that notion of trying to kind of reverse engineer why some things might work the way they do in D&D. And what would it be like if they didn't work that way? And then taking that and putting it into a book. I mean, the ultimate power of the Codex Terranosus, the Book of World Knowledge, right? And it's all about why does this plane work the way it does? The ability is called the Guardian of All the Earth, I think. And it allows the person holding the Codex Terranosus to once, not once per day, once, turn into a phoenix.
Cool.
And then there are rules for what a phoenix is, because there aren't any in 5th edition, I discovered. And then originally doing so was fatal. you just died. It was a last ditch, desperate thing. And people on Twitter were like, that's crazy, I would never use this book. And I'm like, but that's the point. The point is that you would if you were desperate enough.
Right.
Yeah. Phoenix is powerful enough. And also knowing that the players have the Codex Terranosus allows the DM to throw much nastier things at them. Right. Because like, well, you could turn into the Phoenix if you had to.
Yeah.
But I did think that was sort of unsporting to say, I'm going to throw this horrible, nasty thing at you to sort of force you into becoming the Phoenix, which kills you. So now it just requires you to beat like a DC 18 Constitution check.
Nice.
So it's still really hard, right? But if you are healthy enough and your friends are casting like guidance on you and stuff like that, then you can get it down to like lower than 50%, which has happened in my campaign. My friend Lars, playing Salar Baremantle the Druid, turned into the Phoenix and saved the day, and he made his saving throw, and so he's still alive. But I think that, you know, it's just an option. It's just, you don't have to do it. But I think that temptation, I think players, you know, my kind of player is the player who wants to do it. Who's like, I know I could die, but I get to be a phoenix. This is amazing, right? and then the fact that there's this trigger at the end where you might not make it is part of what makes the phoenix cool, right? The phoenix burns up. It's built into the mythology of the phoenix. It's not something I made up. It's just me trying to contextualize it for D&D. So that's just one of these. There's going to be like between 12 and 20 of them, awesome. Which means probably 15.
Awesome.
I'll get to 15 and be like, oh God, I'm done.
Yeah, right?
So there's a whole bunch already in my game, and some of them are just names written down and vague ideas of how they work. But that's, you know, one of the things that playtesting is for, is to put these things in front of people and get a reaction.
Awesome. Well, I know that one of the features of your follower system that I'm really excited about is that you're using different tables for followers for different classes. So not everybody gets the same followers necessarily.
Yeah, not only different classes, but also different alignments. So that's something Folks were understandably confused. Most people seemed to get it. Actually, most people didn't care. They looked at the follower chart and were like, that's cool.
Right.
And then some people were like, but wait, this paladin chart assumes that you're a lawful good and you could be a chaotic neutral paladin in 5th edition now.
Yeah.
I personally think that's absurd, but you can do it. But the chart they were looking at is specifically every follower chart is based on your class. And once you get into like somewhere between 85% is you're rolling percentile dice to see what follower you attract. And if you roll some classes, it's 85 or higher, some it's 93 or higher. Different classes have different ranges for these things. Different classes are like warlocks, I believe, are much more likely to attract special allies than, for instance, a fighter is, because warlocks are used to dealing with extra planar entities. Right? They have personal relationships with crazy, weird things. And so their special ally range is wider than some other classes. But once you get into that special ally range, if you get to like 89 or higher or whatever it is, it literally says, now go roll on your alignment chart, because the alignment chart is your special follower chart. So, and that lets us do all sorts of crazy stuff, because I don't know what your character's alignment is, but I want you to be able to get a bone devil. Because bone devils are cool.
Yeah.
So if you're a lawful evil character, you can attract a bone devil follower, right? How else do some of these bad guys get these minions?
Right.
Right. That's what I feel like I've succeeded design-wise when I feel like I've come up with a design that explains why certain things are the way they are in D&D. Why do these bad guys have these minions? Well, because they're using these rules and they rolled really well on the special ally chart. And that's why this necromancer has a really powerful undead, So, you know, there's all sorts of stuff you can get. That's, you know, you can get a lawful good paladin, or a lawful good anybody can get a key written as a special ally. They're not followers. They don't do what you tell them to do. They're like, they're very powerful entities that approve of what you're doing and are willing to help every once in a while. And I've used these rules. I've been a victim of these rules. I rolled on these charts myself, and I had a pair of Greyhawk dragons as followers, quote unquote. And that was super, just having that in my pocket was always super cool. Even though it only came up like two or three times over the course of 3 years of play, it was still just a neat thing about my character.
Yeah. And it's cool because it puts some of this stuff that's normally in the realm of the DM and NPCs into the player's hands, which you can have a dragon that you ride into battle if you want.
Yeah,
that's
really absolutely cool. You can, yeah. And there's a lot of classic archetypes that we have in our head, and they must exist in D&D. How do I get there? Well, these rules help get you some of the way there.
Awesome.
Like a dragon riding into battle on a paladin.
That'd be hilarious.
Like a paladin riding into battle on a gold dragon. That's always been possible. That's always been up to the DM and if the player wants it and if it makes sense in the adventure. But now there are actual charts you can roll on where that is a result.
Yeah, that's awesome. And a lot of this harkens back to stuff we saw in like old dragon magazines. They had some stuff like that. And
yeah, it's a big part of my awesome channel stuff. Is trying to show people that every style of D&D that's ever been popular is still fun now for some people.
Yeah.
And that you don't have to be worried about fashion. you don't have to be worried about what style of play is in vogue. No one's watching you play at your table. Play however is fun. Yeah. And the way they played in the 70s and the way they played in the 80s and 90s, very different styles from one another, are still fun today for certain groups.
Yeah, or for certain campaigns sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely true. Like a lot of people watch, they've seen me run my game or they've heard me talk about my game and they've watched Matt Mercer run his game and they think, oh, we're very different styles of Dungeon Master. But I think more of what you're seeing is you're seeing two different experienced Dungeon Masters running for two different groups. And, right. You know, any one Dungeon Master, I think, has several different kinds of games inside them.
Sure.
Or at least they should, I think. And if they do it long enough, they definitely will.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about your questing system? That sounds pretty cool.
Well, that's super, super, what's the word I'm looking for? Super early in development. Okay. I've got a couple of things that I want to try and develop. And if I'm successful, put them in front of DMs to make their lives easier. Questing's not that hard, right? You can attract adventuring followers, right? And that's you. In other words, you can literally attract like an order of wizards. Show up and say, I like what you're doing. We want to help. And these guys are followers. They're not special allies. They're all lower level than you, but there can be a bunch of them.
Right? Cool.
And what do you do with those folks? Well, you can send them off on adventures. And there are charts for what happens when you send them off on an adventure. And there are games that do this. I believe, I remember being really impressed with Pillars of Eternity, because one of the things that happens, and this is a video game from from Obsidian, you can, you know, in the classic, like Baldur's Gate games, there are always more NPCs to recruit than there is space in your party. And so you're making decisions that you're stuck with forever. If you leave this person behind, you can never recruit them again. Well, Pillars of Eternity takes that mechanic and says, if you don't recruit somebody, they go back to your base. You end up with a keep. It's perfect, exactly the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
Yeah.
They go back to your base. And when you go back to your base, you can send them out to do stuff. And they'll uncover knowledge. They'll learn things. They'll uncover plots against you. They could die. You could risk their lives. They could come back wounded or in need of help. And all of these things are seeds for a new adventure to give the player something cool to worry about. And it makes them feel like their domain is a living, breathing thing and that the people that work for them are real people going off on adventures.
Awesome. Yeah, that sounds
really
cool.
I also have some optional rules that I'm not sure I believe in enough yet. Playtesting may get us there, but it may not. You always have to be aware that the rules might not get there. But I really want you to be able to take your adventuring followers into combat with you. If you're a seventh level paladin and you attract a fifth level monk, you should be able to take that fifth level monk into battle with you without running an entire other character. And there are very simple rules for how to do that. I know some people won't like them because they will abstract some part of combat out to a point where they don't like, but that's the point of them. The point of them is you don't want to run a whole other character sheet. If you do, and your DM is down with that, then go right ahead, roll up a fifth level monk and run your fifth level monk in your party. There's nothing stopping you from doing that. But if you're like, wow, it's already a lot running my seventh level paladin.
Yeah.
And your fifth level monk can be more like a token in battle that does one thing on their turn. They can like provide flanking and stuff like that, but they don't have, you don't track hit points for them the way you do with a PC. They don't have five or six different abilities like a PC does. They basically do one thing. You can swap what that one thing is out between battles, but the goal is to make it so that I feel like my guy is here with me and he's helping me and he's contributing meaningfully, and that's cool, but I am not running a whole other second character.
Yeah, that'll
those are the rules I'm working on.
That'll be especially useful in parties where multiple characters have followers, because that could get...
Well, and also if you have very few players,
yeah,
and you want a sense of that, a large party, but you don't want each person to be running five or six characters, right?
Right.
Is that, I think if you played fourth edition, has rules for like shamans summoning spirit creatures, right? And they work just like tokens that projected power out on the board, and they would do one thing a turn. And that's basically what this is. And it's going to be deeply unsatisfying for people that want to run an entire second character. But of course, you can always do that. That's this
right.
is explicitly for people who are like, I want my monk with me because he's cool, and I want to have that benefit of having a buddy in battle, but I don't want to run a whole second character. Okay, well, here are some really simple rules. And generally speaking, as long as you're not failing, then your ally's not failing. It's difficult for your ally to get killed out from under you, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, totally. If you want to have another PC to run or even an NPC to run, like, we have rules for that.
Yeah. There's a whole player's handbook that lets you generate that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So those are somewhat experimental, and we'll see how people react to them. No promises.
Fair enough. I love that you're including an adventure with this, which was another stretch goal that you hit. And the actual adventure that you're including, I think, is brilliant, because it actually, for maybe a GM who's already running a campaign, maybe they're like third level or something, it lets you just seamlessly bring this into your campaign, complete with an ultimate stronghold that they end up with. Do you want to tell us about it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a classic adventure. It's going to be fun to, I've already got an outline for it. It's going to be fun to write and put in front of people, because what they're going to discover is, oh, this is just a completely typical adventure. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, it is. Yeah. But at the end of it, you get a stronghold. That is true of a lot of adventures. There are a lot of adventures that are classic adventures, like the Moat House. It's dilapidated, but that's kind of the point, is what looks at first like a dilapidated, rundown place to a player that's read these rules will be like, look at all that money I don't have to spend.
Right.
somebody already spent like a third the cost of this place. All I have to do is fix it. But if you run through the village of Hamlet, the beginning of Temple of Elemental Evil, you could very easily decide we want to have this place as our base. So most adventures already do all the work for you. What I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be putting a town that you start at, and the NPCs in the town, when you recruit followers, when you finish your thing, it's like, oh, that's the blacksmith from town. Now I have some context for why these guys join me, right? It's not just a random NPC. Like, it's fitting these rules into a larger world, so that if you do attract a unit of soldiers, you have some context for where do these guys come from and why did they sign up. And it's basically just going to act as one big long running example. Like,
it's
going to be an adventure featuring, you know, probably orcs or something like that, and a bad guy, and a plot, and it'll be fun to write. You know, a lot of people, like, I think at this point it's reasonable to say thousands of people now have played through the Delian Tomb, which was like one of the first videos I made, where I was like, it's just five encounters and one of them's a puzzle, right? Anybody can do this. It's simple.
Yeah.
And this is that same philosophy, but just stretched out over, you know, four or five times as many rooms and given greater context.
I think it's a fantastic way to do it too, because I mean, I've run for decades, and countless times I've run some adventure, like, for instance, Tyranny of Dragons. There was castle, right. I think it was called Castle Narytar or something like that,
right,
where they go through this place, they clear it out, and the players are like, hey, could we have this as our castle now? And it's like, yeah, okay. It happens so often.
Yeah. Why would you say no to that? Like, how would you say no to that? Like, no, you know, but I there are definitely some players. This is kind of the curse of tabletop role playing. There are definitely some players who feel like if there are not that which is not explicitly allowed is forbidden.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate, because that's not true.
Right.
And you end up when you run Tyranny of Dragons and the players ask if they can have this place as your keep, if you are one of those players, now you're stuck, because you're like, well, there's no rules for this, so the answer must be no. But I can't think of a reason why I could say no.
Yeah.
And so hopefully these rules will help people understand that you can say yes, you can say yes more often. That's a good way of putting, of pitching these rules. These rules allow you to say yes more often and not have to freak out that you have to make up an entire system. And yeah. they should be simple enough. They're really simple. These rules are really simple and straightforward that people are already online. I've seen people say, hey, could I make a, and then they name some crazy type of stronghold. Like, like I was actually just on a podcast, a YouTube stream, and these guys were talking about like a traveling carnival. And there are people in chat that were like, well, that would just be this one thing Matt has talked about plus this other thing Matt has talked about. And that person is the customer for this book.
Yeah.
The person who feels like I need to have everything laid out for me, I can't cover everything. Right. But what I can do is give you enough examples, and they're simple enough that they're easy to combine and make your own unique things.
Yeah. That's awesome. And it's such an organic way to bring this into your campaign, where it's the player saying, hey, we just cleared this cool place. Let's stay here. And just one thing leads to another. And like you said, this adventure, you could either run this actual adventure, or you could use it as an example of how to do this with the adventure you're already running that has a castle or whatever in it.
And if I do a good job with it, it would be a fun adventure just to run, even if you don't care about strongholds and followers. It'll just be like, you know, a cool map, ideally a cool Matt Coldwell adventure, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, see if the players at the end are like, hey, let's take this place over, or maybe
then they're not. But if they're not, if it was just a cool adventure, it should still work. The adventure should still be fun. I think that's, you know, I'm happy enough with the way the Delian Tomb has been received by people that it makes me want to try something more ambitious as far as an adventure goes, because I do sort of feel like adventure design is a lost art, and one that I'm not an expert on, by the way. And that's one of the things I like, is I like being outside my comfort zone. Like I've basically written I wrote the Lord of the Rings role-playing adventure game, which was a self-contained box set for the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, kind of the basic, our equivalent of the basic set. And I wrote that whole thing from beginning to end, and that included, like, I think the Battle of Five Armies is in there somewhere, or the battle, like there's a whole war system I had to come up with, but it was just one big adventure. So I've done a couple of adventures, but I'm hoping that I learn enough writing this one. And it's not a question of, I don't know how to make adventures. It's a question of turning them into products. I know how to make adventures. I've done it for 30 years. It's a question of turning that adventure into a product that people want to engage with. If we are successful at that, then I have plans for at least one big, big, like Underdark adventure in the future.
Cool. Well, I really like your attitude of giving GMs tools, because I really, that's what I like, a product that, whether it's an adventure or whatever, that it's not just like, here's this thing you can use, but like you said, here's an example of a type of thing you can do. Now run with this.
Yeah, here's four different strongholds and two different variations of each of them. And you reading this are going to come up with, that's going to stimulate your imagination.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, oh, what about this? Well, hopefully you'll be able to put, you know, one and one together and get two. One of the things that I have learned by, because of the YouTube channel, and that hopefully it informs the writing of the book and it makes the book more useful to people, is that I will often talk about things I've done in my game. And then in the comments, someone will say, that sounds awesome. How do you do that? Yeah. And I'm like, what do you mean? How do you do it? I just told you. That was it. That was the whole thing. Because what they're imagining is this, I would think, like third edition-esque, this really elaborate, over-designed system running in the background that I have behind the screen. But in fact, often just saying that it happens is all you need to do.
Yeah.
And so that's my goal, is to make sure that players don't read this and go, that sounds cool, but how do I do it? That we actually spend, I think most of the text, certainly most of the stuff I've been writing this week, because a lot of the rules are already done. A lot of the rules were done before we started the Kickstarter. A lot of the stuff I've been writing this week is just how to use it. How to do it? What does it mean to say that what does it mean to say that, like, your pirate ship went and raided a coastal village? What does that mean? How does that affect you? Apart from just saying it, what are the consequences?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I really like your philosophy and approach, and I'm excited to see a book with that kind of guiding it.
Well, I hope I don't let you down, man, because it's, so far, it's a lot of fun to write.
Awesome.
Because it's gonna, and that's another thing, is I'm well aware that they're gonna be people buying this book who are not fans, they're not part of the community, they just want this subject. And some of those people are gonna get not the book they want. And that's the nature of any product, is that there are some people who are gonna buy it and they're gonna have buyer's remorse. I know people, there are gonna be some people who are not gonna like the writing style of the book, because it really is what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
It's all this written down. It's a lot of advice and a lot of asides and footnotes and sidebars and examples. And at one point, I at one point, just because it popped into my head, I added a footnote in the section called the keep. So it's one of four strongholds. There's the tower, the temple, the keep, and there's an asterisk, and it says, by the way, there's a great Michael Mann movie nobody saw called The Keep about Nazis and fighting a demon with an internal man. This has nothing to do with the book, but it's a crazy movie. You should check it out.
Awesome. Right?
That kind of stuff is in the book. And there are going to be people who want just a reference manual, right? They're just going to want an index and they want to look stuff up and they don't want Matt going blah, blah, blah. But I feel like if I can write a book that people will actually read because it's fun to read, then that increases the odds that people will use it. And that is my ultimate goal. My ultimate goal is that people get the book and they use it in the game and they don't feel lost at sea. They don't feel like they sort of half understand it. My goal is that they feel like they get it and they can use it.
Well, one thing you said, I think in one of your Kickstarter videos that I really liked is you said, you know, I hope that you GMs put this book on the coffee table when the players come over so they can flip through it and yep. see the possibilities. And I really like that philosophy. I think you mentioned the same thing with magic items in the DMG yeah. of
or give them put things the magic items in the player's handbook. And that's yeah. where they belong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Players need things to be motivated by. They need reasons yeah. to play. They need reasons to come to the table. And not all players are the same. Not all players covet cool magic items. Not all players look at the map of the world and want to take places over. But, you know, if you've got six players, you probably have six different reasons for people being there.
Right.
And we have the power to satisfy all of them. It's a question of putting the right stuff in front of them and sequestering things like magic items and follower charts. This is how it worked for me, by the way. I was reading a Dragon magazine and I'm like, wow, what are these charts? Look, all this cool stuff you could get. Oh, you have yeah. to be one of these things. Now I want to play this class.
Right. Yeah.
Because they get these cool followers. I want to roll on this chart. If the DM had that all behind the screen and they never got to see it, I never would have wanted to play that class or build a stronghold or any of that stuff. So, yeah. you know, I think that I think one of the things that Wizards of the Coast could do a better job at is indulging different types of players' motivation and yeah. make it so that there is stuff to spend money on. Because people like, especially when I was a teenager, just getting scads of gold was enough. I was happy
yeah.
because I didn't have any money at all. I had no money at all. And when you're in that teenager or even like junior high school state of like, man, just having money is cool. My character is kind of rich.
Yeah.
I didn't even need to do anything with it. I was just happy. Once I actually had a job, that fantasy kind of evaporated because money ceased to be this sort of magical thing and became a much more mundane and somewhat worrisome and troublesome thing.
Yeah.
But just saying having money is cool, nothing wrong with that. Wanting to go into a dungeon because you want to recover, you know, Fragrak, one of the speaking swords that's in the Temple of Elemental Evil, that should be possible. And it's perfectly reasonable to want that. That doesn't make you a weird player. That makes you normal.
Yeah. And a lot of us GMs love players like that because it takes some of the burden off our yeah. shoulders. It's like, it's now I don't have to decide what to do next.
Yeah. It's great to see a player. That's one of the reasons I put Calaril the Vile, who's like a 7th level, actually, I think he's 9th or 11th level bad guy, in front of the players at first levels because I want to, because some of those players in that moment where they see this bad guy who is so powerful that he can ignore them, they're like insects beneath him.
Yeah.
Some of those players are in that moment going to swear to kill him. That to me is as vital and interesting a motivation as seeing, you know, the infernal machine of Lum the Mad and going, where is this thing? I want one. Right? That's, oh, good. I'm glad you want that. I'm glad, you know, people read the Forgotten Realms book and they want to join the Harpers. You yeah. should want to join them. They're cool.
Yeah.
Right. All of these things are good motivations. And I think, we sort of just assume that the players are going to want to save the world. And to me, that's an incredibly, you know, Frodo volunteers for the quest for the ring just because he's a good guy.
Yeah,
that's it. That's it. There's no, it may be aspirational. We may wish that we were like that, but it's not relatable, right? Everyone in the real world is dealing with stuff that they want. Let's play a game like D&D where you can actually get what you want in a heroic manner.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about the book Strongholds and Followers, which I'm super excited about and looking forward to using my campaign. But that's not all, folks. There's more.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You're also making some really awesome looking miniatures.
Yep. Yep. In fact, I think in the next 48 hours, I can't really promise because it's not up to me, we'll have a model, an actual 3D model, a sculpt, basically, for the adult ruby dragon. And before the end of the Kickstarter, we'll have more concept art for the other dragons, and we should be able to get a prototype. Once we have the model, then getting a prototype is relatively straightforward. Mostly because I was thinking of ways, I was writing and designing I'll show eventually in an update this next couple weeks. You'll see some of the spreadsheets I was using to design these follower charts. They're extensive, right? Because I wanted to be tracking, you know, all these different classes and what the odds of get like you could have two different classes that both have a 15% chance of attracting mercenary units, right? But for this class, that's five different mercenary units across 15%. But for this class, it's only two, right? Okay. So you can have the same range, but fewer options or different ranges and all sorts of math that goes into the follower chart. But once it came time to populate the special allies chart, what I was looking for was intelligent monsters of different backgrounds for different characters. And I started to come up short. There's a whole bunch of bad ones, and there's a couple of neutral ones, and there's not many good ones. And so I started to have to invent monsters or go kind of back through my memory and regurgitate old monsters that aren't in fifth edition and say, okay, so, and one of them was I really needed some neutral dragons, because to me, like if you read the metallic dragons are more forces of good, right, even though some of them are like lawful neutral, for instance, or neutral good. They're like neutral good. Right.
Right.
And so I'm
right.
like, I need the, and then the chromatic dragons are more evil, even though there are some of them that are evil neutral. They're way more evil than they are neutral.
Right.
And so what I wanted was a third class so that you can have dragons now on any character's follower chart, because there are good dragons, neutral dragons, and evil dragons. And the neutral dragons aren't just the kind of, you know, the good evil and the good neutral and the evil neutral dragons. I kind of scraped out of those and deposited into yours. I wanted to invent original dragons. And so the notion of doing gemstones, as opposed to as a good analogy for, you know, there's colors and metals. Why not gemstones? And that also harkens back to an earlier era of the game that inspired me a lot when I was a kid.
Yeah, I'm so glad to see the gem dragons, because I was always fans of them.
I've got a great artist that's doing some fantastic work, and like his stuff doesn't look like anything else, and that really excites me. And then figuring out exactly how these, I've got ideas for how these dragons work. If I can make psionics work in a way that is evocative and not dumb, I'm going to do it. But if I fail, I would not be the first person to fail. In which case, they're just going to rely a lot more on magic than other dragons do.
Yeah.
Like one of the things I don't like about fifth edition dragons is they're basically just big bags of hit points with a couple of special abilities. And I would like the gemstone dragons to be more extraordinary.
Cool. That's awesome. Have
more cool, interesting abilities.
So I know that there are various miniatures you can get at different levels in the Kickstarter. What about the stats for the dragons? Are those going to be
the stats for the dragons are going to be in the book.
In the book? Okay. Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
And that's what the great news is, like, I had to get art for the dragons anyway. I might as well use that art to get 3D models.
Yeah.
I had to get art to put in the book. I had to get concept art for these stuff anyway. And there will probably be other new unique monsters that help fill out the special ally chart. So that you can get, I've got my own, they're nothing like Modrons, but I've got my own version of creatures from the Ultimate Plane of Law that I'd love to get art for that I've been using in the past in my games. So, you know, there's all sorts of stuff that is going to be in there. It's all going to be fully statted out.
Awesome. And as if that's not enough, folks, there's even more. Part of what this Kickstarter is also doing is funding a production studio for you to live stream your next campaign.
Yeah, I just want to make sure people listening understand that of all of these things, producing minis is the only thing I haven't done before. You know, even getting the art for the minis. I used to be an art director at Last Unicorn Games, and I commissioned, like, if you go look up the Dune role-playing game, I commissioned that piece of art. I worked with Mark Zug. That's my design. So I've been an art director, I've been a designer, I've printed books, and we've live streamed our game. We built our own TV studio at Turtle Rock Studios, you know, out of PVC pipe and four cameras like this and a whole bunch of lavalier mics and a mixing board and all that stuff. I spent certainly over close to $15,000 of my own money building the studio. And then, you know, Turtle Rock Studios needed the space, which we knew was going to happen sooner or later. And so it turned out that like finding space was going to cost us money and way more than I was comfortable. I started to get really worried and scared about signing a 3-year lease to a place that may have $2,500 or more a month rent. And now it doesn't matter if the stream does well or not. I'm on the hook for $90,000.
Yeah.
And that's like, do I want to risk having to sell my house to pay for the folly of this? And I said, well, let's go to Kickstarter and see, because if people want it, then they'll fund it. And if they don't want it, then thank God I found that out now before I got a lease.
Yeah.
So now we're in a position, though, we're going to do, you know, we've done $1.3 million or whatever. We only needed like, I think, like I said, like 90 grand for a lease for 3 years. Now we can get a nicer lease. Now we can get a nicer place. Now I can make that my office. Now we can do stuff like look at places that have warehouses. People were complaining about the costs of shipping. Well, we found, you know, we went with the partner that I think had the best, they had the most experience and were the cheapest. So the only way to get it cheaper is to either go with somebody who's going to be probably cutting more corners, which we're not happy with, or insource it, do it ourselves, get a place with a warehouse. We can afford to do that now.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think, I mean, I understand the shipping is an additional cost, but if you look at just the price point for the physical book, it's extremely reasonable.
People in like Norway or even like Canada is the worst offender. Something I can't explain, by the way. I didn't cover these prices.
Yeah.
The people in Canada are like, bro, it does not cost this much to send books here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, this is the cost of sending the books and paying for the people who are doing the shipping and who will do it correctly and on time and not lose your book. Because if we have to do it, then you're screwed because it's going to take forever and we're going to screw a bunch of stuff up. Yeah. But ultimately, I have 100% faith in the fulfillment company we've gone with. But that's one of those things where all the people I know that do this, my friend Charles at Monte Cook Games, my friend Jeff Tidball at Atlas Games, they all have their own warehouse. They all insource this.
Yeah.
So that's something where we have enough money now that we can get a nice place and hire somebody, you know, hire a warehouse manager, hire somebody, you know, hire, we just need people to, you know, shipping is pretty straightforward and it should be possible to get people to man the warehouse and put books in boxes and take them to the UPS place.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to point out that the actual price of the book is extremely reasonable, even with the shipping, I think. So,
well, yeah, you wouldn't be, it's again, I my sympathies go out to people that are in the foreign territories who are there. I posted this when I found out about it on Twitter. I was like, are people just used to getting screwed really badly on international shipping? And like, it's one of the most popular things I ever posted. I got hundreds of replies for days.
Oh, yeah.
People are like, yep.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I understand why. And we're actually paying to have the books shipped from the printer to the UK. So we're splitting our shipments on purpose because shipping to the foreign territories from the UK is cheaper than doing it all from the US. And so when we saw that was an option, we're like, let's do it. And that brought the price down to where it is. It was originally going to be a lot more.
Okay.
So we're doing everything we can think of to get the price down.
Yeah. Well, I have friends in Australia and I know what they pay for shipping is bonkers.
Man. Yeah. I think there are ways we can this is all stuff that's purely hypothetical, but future books, if this book is successful enough on its own to warrant making more books, then I would like to talk to people about printing internationally and saying, why don't we just print if instead of having to ship it to Australia, why don't we print the Australia? We're going to have a lot of data now. I mean, and we may be doing the kind of numbers that make it worthwhile to, like, if you have 1,000 units, and if we sell 1,000 units in Australia, I believe then it becomes reasonable to just print the book in Australia, right? Yeah, yeah. If you're only selling 150, now the cost for the book is extraordinarily high because the printing machines don't run at that low a volume. But if we are selling enough, if we're selling enough into Europe, if we're selling enough into Australia or Canada, then, and I was really surprised because when we started this process, we were like, well, we have no idea. This is something we should go back and look at. It's going to be really interesting to see how the data bears out. I would suspect most companies trying to do what we're doing, like for instance, my friend John Wick with 7C, he probably had no idea how many people were going to be ordering from Europe. Right. And there was no real way for him to find out.
Right.
But I had a really interesting metric, and that was where all my YouTube views come from.
Yeah.
And so we based all of our estimates on, let's assume that the number is going to be different, but what if the proportions are the same?
Okay.
And if you had asked me when I thought of that, if you had asked me what proportion of my viewers were overseas, I would have said it would be around 10%.
Okay.
But it's 40%.
Oh, wow.
40% of my viewers are not in America. And so those numbers, if that ratio holds true for the book sales of the book, which it may not, if that ratio holds true for sales of the book, and if even if it's close, because obviously there are some people who would like to pledge but can't because it's too expensive to ship.
Yeah.
Then I think we might be able to print internationally. I don't know. I assume other people have tried this, and if they don't do it, there's a good reason. But, you know, it's something that I'm just always looking for ways to make life easier for the people watching, for the people supporting, for the people buying the book.
Yeah, and I'll just point out that, you know, this is your first effort and you're one dude. And maybe if you are in another country and the shipping is too much, you can just get the digital version.
Yeah.
sidestep that and still show Matt that, hey, I'm interested in what you're doing and I'm in Australia. So here's a vote for Australian shipping in the future.
Yeah. And personally, I'm a big fan of, like, I prefer PDFs. I buy print copies largely to have as souvenirs.
Yeah.
But I use the PDF because the PDF is portable. It's on all my devices.
Yeah.
You know, I put it in Dropbox and now I don't have to worry about it. I know it's on my phone and all my computers and my tablet. And it's searchable and indexable. So I can find the subject I want and click on it and it takes me to that page. Yeah. I know this rule is in here somewhere and I search for it and I find it. And that's just not true of a print book. So I think of PDFs as being like incredibly high utility function.
Yeah. And speaking of that, as far as the value of the physical book, you also get the PDF for that, which is awesome.
$20 for PDF or $30 for the book and the PDF.
Yeah. I mean, that's great. Fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, it's I think it's good value for money. We'll see what people think. All this is predicated on producing a book. All this talk, all this bullshit, it's all predicated on building a book that printing a book that people actually want to use.
Well, I have no doubts. This isn't your first rodeo, as they say. So,
yeah, the stream, you were asking about that. And that's something we've already streamed our game. Like I said, we built a multi-camera studio. We've done it and we're going to do it better now. Like I thought the last stream we did was like a B- C+ stream, but I would like to get the B+ A-. And I think we now have the capacity to do that. And so that's going to be part of the fun. That's not a risk. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
And it'll get better over time. For us, really the only risk is making minis. We've never done that before. And that's why I feel blessed to have artists and sculptors. And I know people that can do 3D prototyping. And we're partnered with a company that makes minis. So we should be okay. But I know something's going to go wrong sooner or later. That's between now and September. Something's probably several things are going to go wrong. And then it becomes a test of how good our planning is, because that's when you see how good your plan is when something suddenly goes wrong.
Well, I watched your live stream of, I think it was called The Assault on Castle Rend, or
yeah, that was right? One of the last ones we did.
Yeah, I thought it was, as far as production, I thought it was really good. I mean, and well, I'm sure I'm sure it'll be better with this new studio. So I think people will be pleased. Yeah, we had really
primitive lighting. We basically had the blast light everywhere. The cameras we're using weren't set up properly. I don't think they had the right ISO. And so I think there are lots of things we can do to make it look more professional. And also things we can do to improve the camera angles to make it look more natural.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had a lot of fun. Also, like the microphones we were using were lav mics. So everyone was tethered. And also lav mics have to clip somewhere, right? Yeah. And wherever they've clipped, when you turn away from that spot, now all of a sudden the mic's not picking you up anymore. So all sorts of stuff we can do now. The sky's the limit, basically. And that's the goal. The goal is, and I promised people this, I said, the more you, the money is going to go to making content for you people.
Yeah.
It's all just there to, we now just have a whole bunch more options. We can get a better office. We can get better gear. We can do all sorts of cool stuff.
Well, awesome, Matt. Is there anything else you want to say to the listener, GMs?
I just want to remind folks that if you're listening to this, and even if you have no idea who I am, just go to YouTube and look for Running the Game, because I think you can be a dungeon master, and you would not only would you be good at it, it's a lot of fun. It's not as hard as it seems. So just go check that stuff out. That's where this all started, and that's what's important to me.
Yeah, and I will link all that good stuff in the show notes too. So
great.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Matt, for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been a blast.
Thank you for having me on, sir. I enjoyed it last time. I enjoyed it this time. We should do it again.
Absolutely. Anytime, man. Well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 209 of Game Master's Journey. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can email me at gamemastersjourney@gmail.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Lex Starwalker. You can call the Game Master's Journey voicemail number and leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening or both, you might even hear your message on the show. That number is 951-GMJ-LEX-1. That's 951-465-5391. Or you can find all that contact information in the show notes. You can find the show notes for this and all the episodes of Game Master's Journey at starwalkerstudios.com/Game Master's Journey. As well as links to connect with the Game Master's Journey community on our forum, Google+, and Discord, where you can share ideas, questions, and stories with other listener GMs. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback for the show, I would love to hear from you. I also want to remind you that I'll have a lot of helpful links for you in the show notes for this episode, including links to Matt's YouTube channel, his Kickstarter, and the sample codex he talked about, as well as a sample table of followers for the Paladin to give you an idea of what kinds of things he's working on. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to help support the show, you can find all the ways you can do so at starwalkerstudios.com/support. I even have some options for you that won't cost any money. The best way you can support the show and my RPG endeavors is to check out my self-published adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. If you'd like to show off your support for Game Master's Journey, you can also get a Game Master's Journey t-shirt or a Trickster's Labyrinth t-shirt. The shirts were designed by my wife, Nikki, and they're gorgeous. However you decide to support the show, I really appreciate it. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on in your sweet stronghold.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production, your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.